Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show, live on Friday. I have with me today, Offense Donald Davey. Offense, how are you doing, sir?
Well, thank you, Nick. Hi to Michael as well, and thanks for having me on the show.
Always a pleasure to have you, sir. And also joining us again today is Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Nicholas, and thanks for Fancy for those kind words. It's the first time we've been together, I think, on the show.
I think so, yeah. So it's fantastic.
Yeah, nice to see you.
It's another sweltering hot day across most of South Africa. My heart goes out to those of you who are living in parts of KZN, which I saw apparently are getting up to in the 40s today, which all I can say is my heart goes out to you. The rest of us who are baking, not quite so much. We shall try to give you our thoughts on what's going on in the country and the world. So let's start off with a little bit of both, which is that Parks Tau, the Minister of Trade, Competition, has announced that South Africa and China have signed a framework agreement that he says will reshape trade relations between the two countries. He was together with the Chinese Commerce Minister Wang Wentou. They signed a framework agreement on economic partnership for shared prosperity. It's that shared prosperity and shared humanity is a phrase that you see all the time in like Chinese government documents, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, which is described as a wide-ranging pact covering trade, investment, new energy, and multilateral cooperation. As China and South African relations continue to deepen, new opportunities emerge for South African businesses seeking to enter the Chinese market, particularly in sectors such as mining, agriculture, renewable energy, and technology. This is, of course, all against the background of the fact that we have had this worsening of relations with the U.S., which is not our biggest trade partner. They hover between second, third, fourth, depending on how you define trade partner. The EU, if you put it all together, is, I think, our biggest trade partner, or maybe SADC, if you put SADC together. China is, as an individual country, our biggest trade partner, but the US is usually sort of just below that ranking. China is committed to sending an inward buying mission to South Africa, whatever that is, has invited the country to participate in both the country exhibition and the business exhibition at the 9th China International Import Expo in Shanghai this November. Beijing also says that it has an invitation to South Africa for a steel investment event aimed at promoting opportunities in the sector. So clearly lots of love between the two governments at the moment and much attempt to show that relations are getting better. And Offense, your thoughts on this? Obviously, you know, these things, the devil's often in the details of them. But this does seem to fit into the larger strategies of both countries, actually, for a change. Often South Africa seems to just blunder around. But in this case, our government said that they were going to diversify away from the United States because of the tariffs and the bad relationship. And also China has been seeking, I think, to undermine the US's trade relations with countries around the world by taking advantage of the tariffs to say, okay, well, we're actually going to lower tariffs and we are going to uphold the old ways of doing things in the World Trade Organization and the trade order and all that. So why don't you come on board the Chinese boat here with, you know, it's great, the water's lovely. What's your take on all that? Do you agree with my assessment there? What's your thought?
Sure. So I do somewhat agree. China's ambitions in the world, especially in the continent of Africa, I wouldn't particularly connect it to a response to Trump's the United States' idea or rather its methods in trying to isolate its way outside of the continent with all the tariffs that are put across the world, the little attention given to Africa by the current administration as well. I don't think China is responding to that. I always thought that this is part of China's plan to expand as far and wide as possible across the world and it's not necessarily taking advantage of the United States not being involved in Africa, but rather it's just doing what it's supposed to do, and the United States is getting a loss out of that. Back in August 2025, at a trade conference, the Chinese government did announce that it would open up its markets from Africa to China duty free to 53 African nations. The one that's missed out is Eswatini. The reason for that is because Eswatini has relations with Taiwan. So this has been part of the plan. And what I find interesting is that when it was first announced in August, I thought this was going to be China's AGOA. But it very much isn't. And I think this is what Trump is also trying to do, what China is currently doing now, which is that rather than having a unilateral trade legislation to allow for duty-free access from Africa to the respective market, what the plan is to make bilateral deals allowing for the perks of AGOA as well as other things. Pox Tao is in China for the weekend, so the framework you mentioned is just one of the many trade deals that are going to be signed. I think a second one was signed this morning as well. You can expect three more, four more. So this has been in the pipeline for a while, and it's the United States that's lagging behind. So with AGOA recently being renewed for 1 year up until the 31st of December, it's going to be laid as a foundation for trade arrangements with the US and African countries. They know AGOA is going to expire, but they see the value in it. Thus, in making these bilateral trade agreements, AGOA, or rather duty-free access, is going to be put on the table. How do we rather turn this from AGOA to a bilateral trade deal? China's already doing that now. The United States is lagging behind. And it's important to also note that South Africa isn't special. This is China doing this with all the 53 African countries that has diplomatic relations with.
And not just African countries as well. I think they've also done similar things recently in Southeast Asia as well, which are kind of similar to this.
Yeah, definitely. Before that August announcement for duty-free access, that this practice has already been going on with some Asian countries as well. So in terms of China, South Africa isn't special. But in terms of the US, South Africa is special because it's not being included in any of these deals that are being signed. When AGOA expires later this year, I'm not sure yet, but I highly doubt that a bilateral deal will be signed where the perks of AGOA still remain.
It was kind of interesting that AGOA did actually end up going through Congress and being renewed for another year. Because I thought that this thing was effectively dead, or at the very least, that if they did keep it going, they'd explicitly remove South Africa. So I think it is worth noting that we did stay in AGOA for another year, which I think is kind of interesting. And I wonder entirely why that happened, because they could have cut us out now, right? They could have said, we're renewing AGOA for everyone except South Africa, which is kind of, what I was expecting. But anyway, there's the sort of general thing that I think, trade is pretty good. You either get cheap stuff or you can sell stuff more cheaply to someone else, which I think is generally good for both parties involved. But Michael, with these things, one of the things that always concerns me is that you can sign all the trade agreements you want and you can attend all the expos you want. But if people can't make money, they're not actually going to invest that much. And, China may have a lot of socialist elements to its economy still. I heard someone recently describe China as having... we've lost Michael. Anyway, I'll question to you then, Fensei. I've heard someone describe China as having a capitalist business sector, but a socialist financial sector, which is kind of a weird thing to think about. Welcome back, Michael. And I don't know, do you think we're actually going to get massive investment from this kind of thing? My feeling is probably not. So Fensei, just with that one, and then we'll get Michael's thoughts.
That was a tough question. So I'm just going to give like one sentence and hand it over to Michael, which is that investment is actually part of the many trade agreements that are going to be signed, which include China being integrated in the manufacturing in South Africa, because there's been talks that, especially with the automobile industry, that manufacturing plants that are currently existing here are being taken away because they're competing with cheap imports from China. So this has been included in the trade deals that are being signed, in the investment deals, and China is being, or at least they're portraying themselves, and South Africa as well as portraying them, as being integrated in the manufacturing side of it.
That's interesting. I wonder if what that will actually look like when it comes to, you know, are they going to actually build factories here, and will they actually make a profit, or is this a sort of an influence system where you prop up businesses that aren't necessarily actually making money for the purposes of ensuring kind of good relations and influence? Michael, your thoughts on all of this? What's your take on where we're at?
I mean, yeah, a couple of things. In your preamble, you mentioned the emphasizing the shared humanity and shared interests and so on. But I think we can probably be fairly bold in saying that, you know, China is approaching all these things in a very business minded way, and not in a particularly charitable frame of mind. And there's no reason why it should. I mean, it's a very big economy. It needs to keep growing. It needs to find markets and all the rest of it. And I suppose before we got together today, I was kind of making some notes and just thinking about it generally. And invariably, when there's a discussion about, you know, a sort of incursion of China into an economy or into a region in one way or another, whether it's influence or cash, there's always this issue of strategic concerns. And I thought to myself, well, you know, from our point of view, maybe the primary strategic concern, but this might well be naive, for any country is to maintain and expand open economic relations with the world. This is fundamentally a good thing. And nevertheless, there, you know, as some of the discussion has borne out, there are potential risks here, and perhaps what it, you know, we could hope that what it bears on us is this very simple idea that our strategic safety, if that becomes a concern, really depends on the strength of our economy. It's our economy that's got to be robust, and that is going to be the only bulwark against interference of any kind or nefarious activities. But I think on balance, and I'd be interested to hear whether Fancy agrees because I don't have your economic expertise, but I would have thought doing business is better than not doing business, that it's better to engage, better to be open to, and just to, you know, take it from there. The question, of course, always in South African terms, is whether the private sector is going to be given the scope to act as it chooses, because that's really the only source of the dynamism in the economy, I think.
Professor?
I'm not an economics guru, but I do agree that doing business is definitely better than not doing business, and yeah. And as well, there's a lot of politics that's always thrown in the air when we mention anything about China. But at the end of the day, South Africa needs investment. South Africa needs jobs, and thus when trade deals are being signed, that the pragmatic side of the analysis should be considered. Are they genuinely going to offer something tangible for the South African on the ground? And if they do, is it not going to hurt the current industries that are existing in South Africa as well? There are already, like I mentioned, with the automobile industry, there are already car manufacturers here and jobs providing jobs to South Africans. When China gets involved, what's going to happen to those people? Are more jobs going to be created in that industry, or are they going to be cut, or are they going to be replaced? Or it just depends what's going to happen. But in essence, in terms of trade deals and trade liberalization and so on, this is good. This is good news. It's business being done.
Yeah.
So if I could sort of play kind of devil's advocate, I just one note before I do that. I mentioned at the beginning that shared prosperity and shared this is it's a very common feature in these government communications. For example, a few years ago, China put out this like soft power thing called a global community of shared future. So then had the subheading for common humanity or something like that, which I think is trying a bit too hard. But anyway, the worst way this looks, right, and this is, I think, what people fear, is that what sometimes does happen when China, or often happens when China invests in a country or tries to negotiate with the political elite of a country, you get lots of very murky influence peddling things. You get like special exemptions from all the rules for a Chinese company that then will, you know, like mine out a game reserve or something like that. And, you know, a lot of labor ends up being people who are, you know, from China, and there's like no local labor being involved in this. Or, you know, there's like a deal to buy a port, and then the terms of it and who's getting kickbacks is very dodgy. I think of China's deal that's still kind of lurking in the background to build a massive upgrade on one of our air bases in the Free State.
Yes, correct.
Which is under extreme secrecy with very few details being known. I highly doubt that that's simply for our benefit. I think that is what people worry about. They worry about essentially the fact that China looks at Africa and sees, look, here's a bunch of corrupt politicians. I'm just going to buy them so that I can sort of strip everything of value and then just take resources and technology and expertise back to China and not actually kind of build a, you know, this is a short-term operation, not a long-term one. So that, you know, an open, normal trading agreement, I think that's good stuff, but that's exactly the kind of thing that you don't want to happen. So you have to keep a close eye on these things to make sure that it's in the direction these things go. Any final thoughts, Offensive?
The skepticism you speak of is very much important, and it's welcomed, and it should be voiced. And the one good thing, there's a few good things, but the one good thing about South Africa is that it has a strong civil society base. It has a strong voice outside of government. So the respective oppositions in terms of civil society, our courts, our institutions, political parties, they will raise their hand if they see something sketchy happening, and that will protect us. So at least there are measures for that, and thus the skepticism shouldn't be a silver bullet to not have a trade relation at all.
Exactly.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, the only reason we know about the military base you were talking about was because it was
Parliament about did its job. Well,
yeah,
some parliamentarians did their job.
Yeah, no, indeed, and so I think you're quite right.
So let's move from foreign affairs to what's going on at home, and in what I'm sure is making the DA feel very chuffed with itself. A question was asked of the Human Settlements Minister, which metros and municipalities have built the most houses since 1994. And probably not terribly surprising, but the largest number of houses has been built by Cape Town, who between 1994 and 2025 have built 202,000 government-funded homes. In Johannesburg, the number is 179,000. In eThekwini, Durban, it's 172,000. And then the other cities are kind of further and further behind. Now, that's a bit of embarrassing for Joburg because, of course, Joburg is the biggest city. I suspect, at least until recently, it was probably the fastest growing city. I mean, I don't know what our recent census said, but that census, as many people pointed out, is extremely unreliable. So, you know, who knows what it actually says. As people point out, however, this is kind of a way, a drop in the bucket. There's this 1.9 million households on the waiting list for a house, people who have signed up, who qualify or presumably will qualify for government housing or government provided housing at some point. Now that's, we don't know, once again, you know, talk about bad data. This is also not a particularly reliable metric as to people waiting for houses. There are people on that list who will probably be removed at some point. There are people who have had their place stolen by someone else who bribed to get onto the list higher up. There are people on that list who have gotten their own house in the meantime, people who have died. It's a whole mess. But we can say that there's probably a lot of people out there who still need houses. I think something like 8 to 10% of the country still lives in shacks, something like that, with about 88% of South Africans living in formal brick and mortar houses, which is a significant increase from 1996, when only 58% lived in brick and mortar houses. So there's in the last five financial years, Cape Town has continued to lead the way, building 12,000 houses. Etegwini second place at 5,300, and Ekurhuleni at 5,000. The city of Joburg all the way down at 4,900, which is just insane considering how big Joburg is. I think this fits into a larger question of, or larger questions of economic mobility, sort of escaping poverty, of affordability. Right, that's the big kind of buzzword at the moment. You've got people in places like Cape Town complaining things are too expensive, or the housing is too expensive, the rent is too expensive, the rates are too expensive. You've got poorer people who are just, you know, desperate to get housing. You've got people who do have a house, but it's really far away from any potential place they could get a job. There's the fact that there's not enough jobs. There's a lot of sort of things that I think feed into this. And it kind of raises the question, is there a better way to do this? You know, should the government be the ones trying to build an RDP house for everyone in the country who doesn't have one? It's increasingly become, while that was once sort of held almost as a sacred tenet of the Constitution, I believe the Constitution does have right to accommodation. I think the difficulty of it has become recognized by many politicians. And so even, you know, if you sort of have ANC politicians saying, well, I don't really know if we can actually do this. Michael, what's your take on this one? You know, this is less, I think, of a super huge issue than it was a few years ago, at least in terms of people just not having houses at all. But those affordability and those travel problems are still a very big issue for people, not just the poor, but even the middle class too, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. The phrase that came to mind when we sort of began talking about this was the one that Terence is quite fond of. Terence Corrigan, our dear colleague, in his Daily Friend show appearances, he'll often say this story has a lot of moving parts. And I think there are a lot of moving parts to this whole issue of housing. So just, I mean, just you were referring to mobility and cost and all the sort of thing. There's a very interesting academic here in Cape Town, UCT. I think his first name is Francois Verulli, he's in urban studies. And he looks at a phenomenon in South African cities. He calls it the 40 by 40 by 40 rule. And it's people living in a 40 square meter house. They're 40 kilometers, it's located 40 kilometers away from where they work, and they spend 40% of their income, the household income, getting to work. So, I mean, that describes a crisis that is repeated every time, almost every time, an RDP house is made. And so that's just one element just to bear in mind. The other one, we were chatting before the show about this, that RDP houses are, you know, given to people, but they then cannot do anything with it. They can't sell it or cede it to somebody else for 8 years. You know, so it becomes a dead asset in their hands, when in fact it with title it should be a valuable asset to them, and it isn't. So that's another issue. But just come back to this ground up story about the metros. I was quite intrigued by the notion. The headline captures the sort of notion of the way that the staff ground up staff wrote the text. It says Cape Town leads metro housing race. So, you know, it's as if there is this contest to get a higher number. And of course, you know, the IRR is kind of close to the DA. We always often getting into trouble for seeming to be meddling in the DA, but we're quite separate from the DA. We have nothing to do with them at all. We're often very critical of them. But we also like the idea of political parties that are responsive, that govern well, and that they do this demonstrably here in the Western Cape, both in the city and in the province. I've been critical of many things myself, but I've been the first to acknowledge that where there's good sound government, you generally get all kinds of better metrics. And that is, I think, very much the case here. So there's something gratifying about that Cape Town leading the entire country on this particular metric. And then you think, you know, it's nothing to do with the DA. It's just it's pitifully inadequate, because it's a national policy. It's not a party one or a city provincial one. The idea that the state provides this housing, because if you think of Cape Town, it's one of the cities in South Africa where the urbanization rate is already at about 70%, expected to rise to 80% by 2050. But in Cape Town, over the period in which the 202,000 RDP houses were delivered, the population more than doubled from 2.3 to 5.1. Obviously, it's not all those people are people who need RDP houses. But an awful lot of people who are, and people are very smart, South Africans, I think, probably smarter than many other nations in the world, they don't actually need a great deal of help to figure out how to make a house and live in it. We've, after all, been doing this for millions of years. And when people come to the city and they see an opportunity, all they need is just a few tips from maybe friends and others. They find a place where there's an informal settlement. There are people there who will provide the corrugated iron and the wood and whatever else you need, and you organize yourself. So there's already this resourcefulness, which in fact most people have to rely on to accommodate themselves, because the 202,000 RDP houses ain't going to come anywhere near them. So they're already doing that. And the real problem is that we need an entirely new model. You know, if metros, it seemed to me, can't afford to be compelled to stick to this model, it's not of their choosing, and that we do really need a quite different approach. And as it happens, the IRR has been working on this, our colleague Dr. Anthony Jeffrey, for a long time. The housing vouchers for housing, health, education also, but we're talking specifically about housing. And then just more recently, under the What South Africa Can Be campaign, launched by Herman Pretorius and his team, they have drafted a law, the Right to Own Bill, which sets out exactly how vouchers can be handed out with state cash. So it's not any money, any extra money coming from anywhere. It's the existing money that goes to housing, but you now do through vouchers. And it's very complicated to explain, to do it here, but I highly recommend listeners to go and have a look at that law. It sets out exactly all the conditions, the safeguards, the guardrails and all the rest of it, to make sure that corruption is not going to be possible. It empowers people where they live. They can use that money to even improve a shack, never mind build a house, but they can get a bond with it. They can do whatever they wish. There's a whole range of things. It's very carefully thought out. It's very well described. Plain language. Illegally solid. I'm back again. With this, you get immediate economic churn, which you don't get where the state is burdened with this responsibility. Here, you've got millions of people making different choices. You're stimulating economic activity. You're allowing people to choose. You get that churn, you're going to see very, very much higher figures than the ones we see here. So sorry for hogging so much time, but yeah.
No. It is a complicated thing, and it touches, you know, where people live, of course, touches on so many aspects of our lives. I think offensive for me. Part of the problem with the discussion of housing is that it's kind of, once again, as this often happens in South Africa, we're talking, this is just a subset of the bigger problem, which is that people are poor. People do not have enough money. If you allow people to build houses, you don't, you know, massively overregulate planning, if you don't completely constrict the housing market and it takes 10 years to build any new housing development and can be derailed by an objection from anyone who thinks that there's like a special butterfly that lives in that field over there, or, you know, because, oh my God, it's going to ruin the skyline or whatever. If you get rid of that stuff, and we certainly haven't got rid of that stuff is all there in South Africa. If people have the money and the opportunity, they will sort themselves out in a lot of ways. People will build houses, people will rent houses, people will do all that sort of thing. I imagine a South Africa where, imagine we could build a house for everyone. And in fact, maybe we could even build houses. Let's say we could just magically create new land and put houses wherever we wanted to so that everyone was close to work. If people don't have jobs, what's the point? Right? What's the point of being given some small RDP house, even if it's super close to where you could potentially get a job, if there just aren't any jobs to get in the first place, which unfortunately is the reality for so much of South Africa. So, you know, I wonder, like, how much of this can just simply be solved by creating jobs, growing the economy, and, you know, giving people more wealth to escape poverty, better education, all those sort of things, to the point that, you know, people will build their own houses. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I always try to avoid using this analysis because I feel like it's a bit lazy from my part, but it's actually the best way to really describe what's going on and how to fix what's going on, which is that economic development is the number one issue at hand. And if there is a growing economy, if jobs are being created and so on and so on, then all these issues we keep talking about wouldn't exist anymore, because citizens themselves would be empowered to be able to build their own homes, to pick where they want to live, to not have to resolve to these other things like building shacks where they're not supposed to build them, for example. If people are empowered, then they can be like, hey, I don't want to live here anymore. Cape Town is pretty nice. Let me find a plot there that I can buy, and then I can build my own house there, and then all happiness. That sounds like a utopia, but really that's how it's supposed to happen. So yeah, definitely economic growth and job creation is needed, with RDPs especially that are provided by the government. They'll normally be built like on the side of a township. So like this one side of the township looks nice, whereas this other side of the township does not look nice. But the funny thing about that is that that area where the RDPs are built and there's these 200 nice new houses, there's no economy around those houses. There's no shops around them. There's no school. There's no recreational activity park or whatever it may be. So really you'd prefer to live on the township side of it, where there are at least an engine garage or a tuck shop in the nearby, a spaza shop,
yeah,
where there actually is an economy, and even schools happen on that side of the the aisle and that side of the town. So these government plans, these government housing, social housing that are provided, especially the old models that we were using, which national government still uses to a certain extent, they aren't sustainable and they're not fixing the underlying problem. The underlying problem being economic growth.
We were all talking before the show. You mentioned you had a relative who had gotten an RDP house somewhere, and that was just sort of, it was not a useful house. Yes, it was a house, but it wasn't, you know, of actual use to anybody. And I've been to RDP settlements which were effectively abandoned. Government spent all this money building the houses, probably at greatly inflated costs to make sure that the cadres got their cut. And now people weren't living in them because they were built in a bad place. They were really poorly built, which is another thing. They didn't have proper sanitation. They didn't have schools, all these other things. And, you know, so this model is extremely wasteful. And yes, you can do this model better, but I think it just opens the door for just so much graft and waste and mucking about. And there's one other point of this. Building housing when you build a house, it's not just like only that's expensive that only the rich can afford. That does also lower the price of everyone else's house because, the market doesn't designate this house is for rich person, this house is for poor person. The market sets prices based on demand and supply, right? So if you increase the supply of housing, the demand falls, the price falls. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting lost on a tangent there, but
if I can
answer your thoughts on dead capital.
Yeah, definitely. On my little anecdote there as well, on my experience of seeing an RDP house, it was of my relatives, is that even the neighborhood is a ghost town. No one's there. No one lives there. There aren't even gates separating the houses, and there's no one inside the houses. So there's also no crime. We can just leave the house as it is because we know no one's going to come here and try to take anything valuable because there's nothing valuable. Some of them have fridges inside of them, but no one's going to come steal them because it's too far. The place is isolated. And also something important that is never considered as well is grass. There's no grass. There's no trees. It's just, it's not attractive to anyone, and it's not livable.
Yeah, no, that's always a problem with so many housing developments, even kind of more middle-class developments. Like particularly I'm thinking back in the 2000s when they built all those townhouse complexes in the northern suburbs of Joburg, and you would just have these vast stretches of, they were all in that like Tuscan style, and they had, those ones did at least have grass, unlike the RDP houses, right? But they had these sort of brown, exactly the same looking brick walls and no trees, and it is just desolate and hot and miserable, and no one wants to live there if they can help it. Okay, Michael, any final thoughts on this one? I think we're going to close up then for today.
Yeah, I think to emphasize that very point, it's all about, what people choose to do. And if you're doing it for them, supposedly, but without consulting them, without thinking about whether they want to live there or not, whether there's a spouser shop or an engine garage nearby, if you're not doing it, if you're not doing a normal kind of social economic assessment of what it is you're doing. And in fact, government shouldn't be even thinking about that anyway. They should recognize that people do this all the time. They're very good at it. You'll see a family arriving here, maybe from Eritrea in the Eastern Cape, and within a year they're settled. They've got all the facilities they need in their shack. They've got a fridge, they've got a TV, they've got the microwave. Kids are at school. They're up early. They're in their uniforms, off to school. The parents have got jobs. People are good at fixing up their lives and getting what they need and what's convenient, and they just need help. That's where the government could really, really assist. Give them more opportunities, give them chances, give them title, and so on. So it's really just to emphasize the huge power of choice. I think it's you multiply that by 60 million, you've got a powerhouse in the making economically. So
exactly, just to emphasize and when people, those who are not, shall we say, super motivated and engaging, when people around you are starting to do that, when everyone is starting to move in the same direction, even those who are not, who would ordinarily maybe not be as self-motivated, are carried along, I think, by the current. And the opposite is true as well, right? Which is when there's no jobs, there's no hope, there's no future, people who could potentially make success out of themselves just kind of go, what's the point? Nothing's going to change. I'm just going to hustle, and I'm going to get my social relief of distress grant, and I'll just hope that maybe I strike it lucky one day with the lotto or something like that. And that's exactly the place we don't want to be as a country. Okay. That's all the time for today. We hope you found this show interesting. We will, of course, be back on Monday to talk about whatever wild and wacky thing has happened over the weekend. And these days, there's always enough news for something interesting to happen. So we shall see you then. Have a great weekend, everyone. Cheerio. See you all then. Bye-bye.